Since we talked about Nebuchadnezzar yesterday, I thought we'd start with...
My mother's loved the bunny as much as I do. I ask myself.
So that's King Nebuchadnezzar. And in the story of... I'll put my mic on as this is on. But in the story of VeggieTales, he owns a chocolate factory that only makes bunnies. He loves the bunnies. And... Yeah, VeggieTales has distilled the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who were Israelites in captivity who refused to bow down to the king. They've distilled that into a story about peer pressure. Huh. So here's the famous classic song about the bunnies.
Why don't they love it as much? Do you know why? Because it's small. It's a little bunny. What they need is a bunny they can look up to. And I mean way up to. This is just a model. The real bunny is 90 feet high. My workers finished it this morning.
Wow, that's a big bunny, sir.
Mm-hmm. Since you're my junior executives, I wanted you to see it first. But this afternoon, everyone will meet the new bunny. And it's gonna be a beautiful thing when everybody bows down and sings the bunny song.
I don't think I'm familiar with that particular tune. Could you just hum a few bars?
You know, I was hoping you'd ask. The bunny song is how all my employees will show just how much they love the bunny. How nothing is more important than the bunny. How they do anything for the bunny. And it goes something like this. The bunny, the bunny, whoa, I love the bunny. I don't love my soup or my bread, just the bunny. The bunny, the bunny, yeah, I love the bunny. I gave everything that I had for the bunny. I don't want no health food when it's time to feed. A big bag of bunnies is all that I need. I don't want no buddies to come out and play. I'll sit on my sofa, eat bunnies all day. I won't eat no beans, and I won't eat tofu. That stuff is for sissies, but bunnies.
Win at work by communicating with Grammarly.
Well,
he is emailing a difficult client.
I think we should explore.
I don't want to tell you a joke that is funny. I just want to play that a funk and a bunny. I don't want to play on a day that is sunny. I just want to play that a funk and a bunny. I don't want to
the bunny. Whoa, I just want to play that a funk and a bunny. I don't want to tissue with my nose is funny. I just want to play that a funk and a bunny.
What would happen, say, if someone didn't quite agree with everything in that song, so they didn't sing it? What would happen?
What's that over there?
That's the furnace.
What's it for?
Well, that's where the bad bunnies go.
Let's just say, in my mind, if you don't bow down and sing the song, you're a bad bunny.
You don't mean...
But I'm sure that won't happen. It's almost time for the ceremony. I'll see you out there.
Now,
VeggieTales takes a dark turn.
That bunny song was chock full of stuff they knew was wrong. But if they don't...
Rack Shack and Benny. Let's see. That. Yay. Well, how's every... Is this, working?
Yep.
Okay. How's everybody doing this morning?
Good.
I found my dental floss this morning, so it is a very good day. I've been hurting. Thank you for all the interest yesterday, the questions, and the discussion afterward. Very fun, and great to be engaged in this conversation. Yesterday, someone asked me, why did you want to teach this at Holt? It was our inquisitive young person. At Holt, why did you want to teach this here? And I thought, why? Why did I sign up for this? The reason that I offered this course is I think in our times, this is important. And I feel like if change is going to come to bring peace, I feel like it's not going to come from the government, or at least not right away. I feel like the church is not the only agency, but that's the agency I work with. And I feel like the church and sibling, you know, all of the sibling faith movements, we share these commitments. When you get to the core of Islam, when you get to the core of Judaism, when you get to the core of Christianity that is descended, Islam and Christianity both descended from Judaism. We are all, as it's called, people of the book. We share the same commitments at our core. And so this Jubilee theme is a great one for us to be in the midst of, because the return, renew. I feel like that is the movement that is going to come. You know, the word radical comes from the word root. And I feel like, you know, the word radical has taken on many identities, including many negative identities that are violent or forceful or bullying. But the word radical is root. And so I feel that faith communities are the ones to be radicals, to return to what our commitments are. And since I operate within a Christian environment, that's where I go. And for all of you, you have your places, whether that's secular, Christian, humanist, Jewish, Islam, Buddhist, all the things. whether that's the work you do with Native communities, with your own white community, with the white community, with the black community, with people of color, with ecumenical and intergenerational and intercultural communities, I feel like getting to the root is helpful to sort of remind ourselves what it is to be human. So this course is a way of doing that, I feel, that for those of us who use the Bible, who see that the Bible has had an enormous influence on Western culture, whether in good and bad ways, I feel like understanding where it comes from helps us read it with better lenses. And I hope that's why I wanted to have this conversation. Plus, I just wanted to be in conversation with people who share those commitments. Yes?
So I agree with everything you're talking about from our perspective of faith, but then there's Christian nationalism.
Yep. Oh, and that's the question? you're putting that out there. Yeah, there's Christian nationalism. Yes. In my definition of Christian, I might argue that that would have some Christian nationalism. Depending on how you read what Christian is. But you are right, that is what makes the news, isn't it? Nobody in the news is going to read about Holden Village talking about empire and the Bible and figuring out what to do with that in our own lives, right? And so, yeah, that is something. Tomorrow we'll talk more about Constantine and Western civilization and some the theology that has come through the Bible and then through the ages. And on Friday, we'll also talk about now what. And I think that that conversation is through all of this, but definitely that is something to be discussed. Yeah, I have a friend on Facebook who, I have a friend in real life, and we're connected on Facebook. And politically, we could not be farther apart. He was grateful when Trump was elected. He was celebratory. He's a pastor, a gentle, kind soul. His work is with women who are pregnant without resources, and so his work is the work that we need to be doing. If Roe versus Wade is overturned, his work is what, and we agree on that. But he's doing it in Edina, Minnesota, you know. And so what the hard part of the conversation is that that's not everywhere. So what happens when you don't have Roe versus Wade and governmental protections for 51%? But he has been posting, since the Roe overturn, he has been posting Bible verses about, you know, the Lord is my strength and my shield, I shall not be put down by my enemies. And I feel like I could post those same verses, you know? We agree on what that means, but we disagree on what that means. Does that make sense? So yeah, that's, and I think if you've been to, I don't know how many of you were able to go to Jeff's session yesterday, but talking with those people, talking with these friends and beloved ones in our lives about science and about truth that is verifiable in data and studies, and you know, 99% of science-y people agree that climate change is a real thing, and yet, you know. So yeah, thank you for bringing that up, and please keep coming with that so we don't forget. I know for me it's easy up here at Holden with a community that is, I feel, is generally in agreement, even though we have our discussion points. It's easy for me to forget that we're kind of on the mountaintop, right? We're not even kind of. We are on the mountaintop. And we have to go back. So, yes?
Well, I just want to state the obvious that for me, Christian nationalism and Ku Klux Klan and any kind of organization, even though they call themselves Christian, if you look at what they do and the policies they promote, They're promoting something opposite of what I think Jesus stood for in the world. So,
yeah, and yet they find justification, right? I mean, slavery found justification in the Bible.
Yeah,
which is also why I think these conversations are important. And I, you know, yesterday when I said what is the Bible, I was not prepared to keep up with all of the knowledge and understanding and beliefs, and you know, I mean, this room knows things, you know, and I think that's why these conversations are important, so that we can look at, you know, the way certain things are read in the Bible and say, that's not the whole story, or that's the tradition that has come up at the expense of these other verses. You know, that we were talking somebody and I were talking yesterday about, you know, those verses that are sort of cherry-picked about homosexuality that have been used for centuries as what my professor Carolyn Pressler called clobber passages, that have been used as clobber passages. And, you know, there's also the story of David and Jonathan, that if, as the same professor did, if you distill all the passages that tell that story, and you change Jonathan's name to Joanne, they're falling into each other's arms, weeping and kissing and crying and yearning for each other. But that's a little harder to describe in a nutshell than a single passage plucked out. They call that eisegesis. Exegesis is the practice of digging into a text, looking at the text around it, doing the work, the word studies, the commentaries, all of that to preachers do this every week. Exegesis, you pull out X. Eisegesis is that you bring your own assumptions to the text. I used to do this all the time. I would look for passages on friendship. I put those in the cards to my friends on their birthdays. That was probably a little innocuous, but but you hear what I'm saying. Eisegesis, this grabbing of texts with an ignoring of the rest. So, shall we? Yesterday we whipped through about 1,000 years of history very quickly. So I just wanted to just come back really, whip through it again, but with slides. So, we talked about the Fertile Crescent yesterday. I just put this up here again to give you an idea of why the land in Israel, and I also can reach it this time, why the land in Palestine was so important. So you see, here are the rivers, here's the places where people can live, and look what's happening here. This is the passage to Egypt, another empire, which also, this should also be green. It's not part of the Fertile Crescent. That's why it's not. But this is the passageway to get there without having to cross the desert. And so this land is key for trade, for conquest, waging war on these people to get their stuff and the other direction as well. So that's, I just wanted to put that up there too. And I also wanted to point out, Ur is here. Who comes from Ur?
Abraham.
Abraham comes from Ur. And we're not going to dig into this too much, but I just want to point out, in the story, we will talk later about how we receive the written texts from the Babylonian captivity. In the Babylonian captivity, there was a realization, we are a diaspora now. Our stories will be lost unless we write them down. And so they start collecting the stories, and they tell them as a whole. So there were maybe stories about the ancestors, Abraham and Isaac, Jacob. And as those stories were collected, details were added. Just like when I had mentioned to somebody the movie Harriet. How many of you have seen Harriet? Just a few. The one Harriet Tubman movie. I highly recommend.
Oh, Harriet Tubman. Yeah.
That one. That Harriet. Not the other one that we all know
Harriet.
About. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And in that movie, there are these characters that are what they call composites. For example, if you've seen it, there's a woman that owns a house that Harriet lives in when she becomes free and lives in Philadelphia, right?
I think it's Philadelphia.
Yeah. Yeah. That woman didn't actually exist. But there were people like that. So for the movie makers, the more efficient way was to make a composite character that showed what people did. So when the priests were in Babylon performing pastoral care for these traumatized exiles, they began writing stories down. And there may or may not have been in the stories already the idea that Abraham came from Ur. But it sure works out well that Abraham comes from close to Babylon, right? And God says, you're going to be okay. And so I just wanted to point out, that's here on the map. And that becomes a significant place, or remains a significant place, we don't know, in the story of how Israel came to be out of the land of out of the Babylonian Empire and into their own land. So that's that. I just wanted to point out especially why this is important to all the people who are fighting. This is, I just wanted to show a little better the northern and southern kingdoms. This area is called by Western people the Levant, which comes from the French lever. Any French speakers? Yeah, to raise up. The sun rises in the east. So this is called, by people in the West, the Levant. It's a way to refer to this whole area by Western scholars. But I just wanted to point out, this is kind of where things are. You see that Philistines are over here, and all the kingdoms that we hear about war with, Edom, Moab. We also hear about Moab. Who lives in Moab?
Ruth.
Yep, Ruth and Naomi. Ruth is from there, and then they move over to Bethlehem. So this is kind of where everything is situated. Here's Jerusalem, which we talked yesterday about how Solomon built the temple there. I don't know if I explained this really well. He centralized worship, and Jay isn't here. Jay asked the question. So this is part of your notes.
I got you.
Asked the question, where did they worship before that? They worshiped in their towns and wherever. They had, you know, their places, their high places, their, you know, piles of stones, their perhaps buildings even, that were their places of worship and sacrifice. What Solomon did was said, this is the most legitimate place because God lives here. So the farther away you get, the farther you are from God. So that was the problem, because look where the northern kingdom goes. In the northern kingdom, Samaria is the capital. And then over the years after the Assyrian and Babylonian conquest, that area up there becomes Samaria. And I talked about how, yeah, as we know, if you've read the Gospels, the Samaritans are at odds with the Jews, and the Jews are at odds with the Samaritan, and it's this centuries-long sense of betrayal, sense of, because as soon as Jeroboam became king of Samaria, king of the northern kingdom, as soon as the split happened, he built idols, and kind of out of spite for the centralization, like, God lives there, well, here are your idols, God's right here. And so that, Jeroboam sort of becomes shorthand for terrible king. So if you read the book of Kings, the northern kings are always terrible, because it was people from the south who wrote the book of Kings. So the kings are always terrible, and there are a few good ones, but most of them follow after the sin of Jeroboam. So that guy, who the son of whatever his dad's name was. So those guys exist forever and not in a good way. So that's the Levant. So I mentioned yesterday King David. I mean, a lot happens before this, but no, Simpsons, no. Probably looked more like that. Which is, I think, another thing I had to learn is that Moses, David, all these people were not white. And in fact, looked like Palestinians. So, yeah. Though if they were like the Simpsons king, that would be something. So David unified the tribes of Israel. We need to think of him more as a clan leader, not as King Arthur on the throne. Solomon in 970 built the temple at last. I talked about he forced labor, which actually is in the Book of Kings. There's like a sentence. He forced labor. And he was so wise, and he forced labor. And he increased taxes on the northerners. Nobody's happy with that kind of stuff. His son Rehoboam totally owned that he was a terrible, ruthless king. And in 931, he becomes king, and surprise, surprise, 1 year later, the north crowns its own king. So Jeroboam, anointed king of the north, Game of Thrones people. And he ordered the worship of idols. He builds high places, which the Israelites had high places. High places were high places that were closer to heaven. And like the Tower of Babel was going to be the ultimate high place. But he built, and you hear later as the story goes on, high places start becoming a bad thing. That's where the idols are. Yes?
So there were, as I read the narrative, there were two kinds of things that were criticized. One was worship of idols,
mm-hmm.
but there was also unauthorized worship of Yahweh.
Oh, right. Of course.
That and so like in Psalm 120, my eyes look up to the hills, from where will my help come?
Mm-hmm.
The rhetorical question, the answer is not from those high places up on the hills.
Yes, but from where? From the Lord.
From the Lord, yeah.
Thank you. Yes. So unauthorized worship. He's so saying unauthorized worship of Yahweh because it's not in Jerusalem.
Yeah, so it wasn't that they were primarily idolatrous. It was that they were unauthorized worship of Yahweh apart from Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, they even made idols of Yahweh.
Yes, thank you. So unauthorized worship and also idols. Thank you for that. And just so everybody can hear, you mentioned Psalm 121. I look to the... No, I can't read it.
120.
I look 120.
Well, I think it's 120.
120. I look to the hills. Where does my help come from? Yeah, I'm going to stop trying. Yep, you said it. Good job. So then here's the line that shows up again and again. He did the king, whichever one they're talking about next. He did not turn away from the sins of Jeroboam, and that becomes shorthand for bad. Yes?
I don't think we can blame all the idolatry on the, what was idolatry on the kings. The people weren't farmers when they arrived, and they had to learn to farm to live in the Canaanite land. So they asked those who were there, how do you do this? And they would say, well, you pray to this goddess, and you pour this libation, and then you put the seeds in, and they, and of course their religion was integrated with their farming practices, so the temptation was, if we want to be good farmers, we worship this goddess, and so forth.
Then yeah, thank you.
Prostitutes to go with it.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that wasn't exactly the... Yeah, but that happened too.
Yeah, and also that.
It's scriptural. It's got to be okay, right?
Yeah, and you know, we all... Yes, and thank you for that. I think that's sort of extra-biblical, but that is true, that when Israel came into the land, they were no... You know, I mean, this is like... They weren't nomads yesterday, and they did this today. You know, there's a process, but... As that process continued, they had to learn to live in one place on the land, so farming. And they didn't come into a place where nobody was. You know, they didn't, they came into a place where other, and they lived alongside other people. So their culture developed with, you know, practices from, that they learned as well. And part of that was, well, we pray to this goddess for a good harvest, and we pray to this god for rain, and, you know. So there was, you know, as their own theology was developing and becoming what we know it to be, at least from what we receive in the scriptures, yes, those things were happening too, and thank you for bringing that up.
War guards aren't very good at farming.
Yeah, that's right. All right, so then, said this yesterday, but I just wanted to, I wanted to bring it up again because all of this, I know some of you might be thinking, when do we get to the empire part? Well, all of this is the groundwork. That, you know, the empire part didn't happen. That there is this, all this stuff leading up to it that led to where Israel ended up. So in 722, after the kingdom divided, you know, of course, then they're more vulnerable. Sorry, I don't know where to stand to not be in your way. They're more vulnerable, and the northern kingdom is closer to Assyria, and the Assyrians invade and they occupy. They don't take anyone out, they just occupy. And so that becomes part of the Israelite culture as well. And so marriages happen, and children are born, and you know, business is done, and religion is practiced. And as we already talked about, their descendants are the Samaritans of Jesus' day with all the baggage that comes with that rift. In 586, so just a little bit later, Judah was invaded for a second time by Babylon. There had been an earlier, There had been an earlier shot by Babylon. And they were always sort of an imminent threat. And then finally, in 586, they just burned it to the ground, knocked everything down. The temple was destroyed, and the 1%, this is my wording, the kind of the elites, it wasn't all of Israel that was carted off. People, you know, they didn't care about farmers and illiterate folk and people with no power and resources. They took away politicians, artists, the ones who could envision. You know, think about how important artists are in every movement. Writing songs, producing images, showing up with, you know, with their creativity and their imaginations about what could be and how to get back to what we want and how to get to where we want to go. So artists, scribes, you know, people who are literate and can write, wealthy and powerful. They're taken to Babylon. And P.S., lots of people are left behind. Whose story I would love to know. You know, we, like I said, we receive so much, almost, I think, all of the Older Testament, most of it, all of it, from either people who were in Babylon or the people who came back later. But, you know, there's 50 years of culture happening. And there is a theory, what they call source theory. Source theory is figuring out who contributed to the writings of the scriptures in the Old Testament. There is a theory that there is what they call a G source. I don't know what G stands for. And the main, some of you probably know this, the theory is that there are four contributors mainly, J, E, P, D, and those all stand for different perspectives. The G source, some people are thinking that there may have been either stories or perhaps even written work that's been lost from those folks. I would love to see that. As one of my teachers said, it only takes the turn of a spade to change everything we know. So maybe that spade will turn. 50 years goes by, so a couple of generations in Babylon. 538, Cyrus of Persia, who is described as a Messiah in the scriptures, a deliverer, described as a Messiah. He, and it's not just him, there are probably a few other army people too, but they defeat Babylon and they free the exiles, and some, not all, return to Judah. So again, not everybody just packed their bags and left, like Saturday morning here at Holden Village. It is like Saturday morning, actually, because some stay behind. Some return to Judah, and then the books of Ezra and Nehemiah talk about what happens, how the temple is built, some of the conflict that happened. Again, it's written by the winners. So Ezra and Nehemiah describe the purging of foreign wives and children. And there's a woman who speaks out against this. She is portrayed, of course, as the bad person, the bad girl, the bad guy. History is written by the winners. And some feel that the book of Ruth maybe is an answer to that. That in the wisdom of the final, what we call the final form, those down the road from this event who gathered and kind of finalized what the Hebrew scriptures would be, that they included contradictory texts because they recognized this is a conversation. So some think that Ezra and Nehemiah, and it's not a huge story, but it is a huge story. Doesn't take up a lot of space in the books, but that there's this purging of foreign influence, and that, you know, nobly as we build this temple and return to Yahweh. Well, what they're saying is the people that came back were in charge, even though we haven't been here for 50 years. And there's that conflict. And many scholars think that the book of Ruth, where you have this foreign wife who accompanies Naomi and then becomes the grandmother of
King David,
that is the answer to Ezra. That a whole book sort of answers those few verses. And a whole tradition in all the other scriptures about welcoming the stranger and the foreigner, and there's a lot to that too. You welcome them, but they have to become like you. But so they rebuilt the temple, and that temple stands until 77 CE, what we used to call AD. By the way, I don't want to just throw that out there like poof, but we say, you know, you understand what I mean. We say BCE and CE because it's much more respectful. You know, in a time perhaps when there was no internet, Martin Luther's time, like I'm not talking like my childhood, like Martin Luther's time. which I think Omar's children think is my childhood. They've asked me more than once how old I am, and the first time they asked me, and I said I was 58, is that like 100? No. Go play. A.D. in the year means the year of our Lord in Latin, and B.C. Does B.C. stand for?
Before Christ.
Thank you. You know, that's a very specific and culturally centralizing way to define time and history. Mm-hmm. So when nowadays in academia and elsewhere, BCE, before the Common Era, still kind of centralizes a certain Western idea of Common Era, industrialization, civilization, but it's a little better. And so BCE before that, CE, Common Era. So Cyrus, then we jump ahead a little bit. So now we're getting into how we get to Rome being in Jerusalem. And we'll come back to other things later. But Alexander takes Jerusalem. This is Alexander's empire from India to, what is that, Turkey over there? Macedonia and Egypt. I mean, that's enormous when you consider the time that it was. And then in 323, Alexander dies. His empire is split between his four generals, and Ptolemy the First gets Egypt, Palestine, and some other places. Now, this is just a quick rundown to get to Jesus. Ptolemy Antiochus the Third, Ben Sira, who I think has a book in the Apocrypha, doesn't he? There's some writing in the intertestamental writings. Yes. I feel like that's a more familiar name to me. Then Antiochus IV is the super meanie who desecrates the temple, and that leads to the Maccabean revolt, and the Maccabees win. And then there's this little period of time where Jews actually have their own people in leadership, the Hasmoneans. I don't know why are they called Hasmoneans. Anybody know?
It was their surname.
Oh, their surname. Okay. Thank you. But then, alas, in 63 BCE, Pompey from Rome takes the Levant and Jerusalem for Rome. And then we get into names that maybe are a little more familiar. Herod the Great builds... why do I have builds the second temple? I don't know why I have that, because the other people... What's that?
Well, he completely remodeled it.
Oh, okay, thank you. When you do your research at midnight here at camp with a sliver of internet, sometimes you forget why you write things down. And then Herod Antipas, Herod the Great, Herod Antipas IV. Now we're in the Common Era. He was the one we hear about in Jesus' time. And then after that time, Paul writes the epistles. Those are the first in the New Testament, Newer Testament. Oh my gosh, look at the typos. No, don't look at the typos. gosh, sorry, everyone. You have no idea what I mean when it says Matthew and Luke and Mark. I know.
Your secretary is not going to get a promotion.
I know, she's so fired. Paul writes the epistles maybe 20-ish, 30-ish years after Jesus. Does anybody know what the first epistle is? We think? What's that?
First Corinthians?
First Thessalonians.
First Thessalonians is believed to be, until the next turn of a spade, that is believed to be the first. So another great workshop would be, what would the New Testament look like if the books were ordered chronologically? If the Bible started with the letters and then went to Jesus.
Yeah.
And then Mark, Matthew, and Luke were around, came about, you know, around the 60s. We don't know exactly when, but that's when Mark was the first gospel written. And then Matthew and Luke are somewhat contemporaries. And again, with source theory, you can see, I'd love to get into this too, but you can see how they borrowed from each other and from Mark. So now, you know, these writings are becoming, are circulating. And people are starting to get, you know, their ideas from farther away. And yes?
So the date I remember for the Second Temple being destroyed was 70.
70?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And there's some internal evidence in Matthew, Mark, and Luke that Mark was written shortly before the destruction of the temple. Mm-hmm. Matthew and Luke seem to have been written afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the little apocalypse where Jesus talks about the destruction of the temple,
mm-hmm.
it's more vague in Mark and more specific in Matthew and Luke, like maybe they'd seen it happen.
Yeah. You know, I'm much more of an Old Testament scholar, but there's no excuse for that. Yeah. What he's saying is, in one of the theories is that Matthew and Luke actually came, were written after the Second Temple was destroyed. And so when Jesus is talking about, I will destroy this temple, when they're looking back and writing the story of Jesus, they're including that trauma to speak to their audience, to have Jesus speak right to their contemporary audience. So thank you for that. I'm sorry that it's a little, that it's not quite right there. So now I'm scared to say, John came at the end of the conversation. Let's go to the next slide.
I think that's the consensus.
Oh, phew, okay.
Just helping you.
What's that? Yeah, no. That I appreciate that. That's why we're here together. So I'll fix this for the next people, and they'll think I'm so smart. So you can see in the Gospels with the correct dates, you can see some of the reflection of the times. And you know, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are called the Synoptic Gospels, which means syn, like synthesizer, S-Y-N. Similar, synthesized, and then optic, they look the same. That you can find stories that are almost verbatim, some cases actually verbatim, from each other. John, poor John, came a lot later to a completely different audience at a different time. And so, you know, in John we see that the Jews are absolutely the worst people in the world. Well, Jesus was a Jew. So how do you reconcile that? Well, by the end of the first century, Christianity, which started as a sect of Judaism, something I never learned in my, you know, past that I told you about yesterday, as a very conservative, literal reading Christian, Jesus was a Jew. And Christianity, Jesus wasn't Christian, as we all know. So Christianity, hey, I'm me, I'm a Christian. Christianity was a sect of Judaism, not called Christianity, called the Way and other things. And as there were other sects, like the Zionists, and that's the other sect I know, there were other sects as well. Pharisees and Sadducees were their own sects as well. And they just, you know, they read scripture differently. I think the Sadducees were kind of the literalists, right? Like unchanging, like the originalists with the Constitution, you know, that it is what it is. Pharisees were the ones who read for their times, you know, in the context. How do we read this? And, you know, some people have said, I'm not sure about this, but some people said maybe Jesus was a Pharisee. Because Jesus also did that, right? Looked back at the scriptures and read for the times. How do we apply this now? So Christianity was a sect, and the Way was a sect. And by the end of the first century, it is really becoming its own thing, even before that. It's really becoming its own thing and becomes its own distinct religion. And for the Jews, I mean, think Samaritans and Israelites. For the Jews, you know, this becomes a point of tension because who are they all worried about? Rome up here, you know, overall. And this does not look good, that these Christians are preaching another kingdom, and they're talking about things that sound like revolt. They're calling God Father, not Caesar. Caesar was the father of all. And, you know, the ultimate to be worshipped next to the gods of Rome. And so the Jews are not happy about this. And so in John, when we read the Jews, as it's often translated, we really should read some of the Jews. And I encourage you, when you are, especially at Easter, boy, we have a bad history of anti-Semitism at Easter.
Good Friday in particular.
What's that?
Good Friday.
Good Friday in particular, yeah. There's so many ways to rehabilitate Good Friday. But I really encourage you, as you're reading those texts, to just make that change yourself. Some of the Jews, or even name like the people that you think, you know, the Pharisees, but it wasn't even all the Pharisees, you know. So anyway, that's a side. Yes?
I've heard many scholars say that Judaism, as we know it, developed after the split between Jesus, they don't refer to as a Jew, but as a Judean.
Yes, yeah, thank
and
you.
Judaism developed when we split mm-hmm. with Christianity and Judaism split.
Yeah, the identity of Jewishness starts, I think, back even in Babylon. But yes, Judeans become Jews, and it is probably solidified then. You know, as time goes on, it becomes more and more of this distinct identity. And certainly after the way becomes Christianity, and in conflict rather than in conversation with their Jewish kin. You had something to say before.
Oh, and just brief summary of the Pharisees and the Sadducees.
Yeah, thank you.
The key thing to know about Pharisees is that they thought that if you're to be a faithful follower of the God of Israel, the most important thing to do is keep the law of Moses as strictly as possible.
Mm-hmm.
So Pharisees' law. And the Sadducees thought the most important thing to do for faithful followers of the God of Israel is to do the temple rituals and sacrifices mm-hmm. as excellently as possible. So Sadducees, temple, mm-hmm. Pharisees, law.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Yeah, so he said, just to define Pharisees and Sadducees, they're not the same thing, though sometimes people put them together as the same. They had a different core value, a different theology about what it means to be a faithful follower. And Sadducees were about the righteousness of following the law, keeping the law.
Sadducees were...
Oh, did I say Sadducees? I meant Pharisees. Yeah.
Sadducees are temple. Sadducees, temple, Pharisees, law.
Mm-hmm.
Pharisees believed in resurrection. Sadducees generally didn't.
Yes. So I'm saying it again so everybody can hear it. So Sadducees, temple, the practices of the temple, the sacrifices, the worship. Now I keep getting them mixed up in my head. And Sadducees did not believe in resurrection. Pharisees did believe in resurrection, life after. And were about the daily practice. So you can see why they were more about mm-hmm. contextualizing the Torah. Which, by the way, Torah means instruction. Torah does not mean law. And it's referred to as law, even in the Older Testament. But what it means is instruction. And I find that to be really exciting. To think that this, somebody said yesterday, right? Somebody said the Bible is like a rule book or a manual.
Right.
I love the idea that the Torah is instruction. And, you know, the Ten Commandments, they're good for us, right? I mean, that's how we should behave. It's not like a meh, meh, meh. But yeah, we should be nice to people. And we shouldn't kill each other. And, you know,
no,
spiritual practices are good. Meditation is good. All those things. So, the Pharisees, I like to try to cast them in a bit of a positive light, knowing that the gospel writers were writing at a time when there was a lot of tension.
They
could have been very sincere people who were very interested in helping others. We're going to keep going, okay, because we're almost to the end. We'll touch on this a little bit, and then we'll get into it more tomorrow. Theology. There's a lot of it. What does the word theology mean? Someone who hasn't spoken yet.
Word about God.
Word about God? Yep.
Study of religion, isn't it?
It literally means, yeah, that's kind of where we take it, isn't it? God, theo, and log, word, logos, can't think of any other word with log right now, but it's there.
Logic,
thank you. I was thinking logistics because we the locals have talked a lot about what are the logistics for getting here and being here. So God talking about God. And yes, that does play into that for sure. So the first century Jews had a very different theology than the people we were talking about earlier who were carted off to Babylon. I'll talk about it a little bit. I made you get Bibles, so I'm going to make you look up something. I'm going to make sure we use those today. Let me find it here. I have three different passages. Would someone look up Job 1, starting at verse 9, starting at verse 6 to 12. And then someone look up 1 Kings 22, 19 to 22. And then someone look up Psalm 95. Okay, so someone, is it there? Someone look up Job 1, 6 to 12. Someone look up 1 Kings 22. Nope, not a new slide, there we go. And Psalm 95, 3, and then 6 to 7. So this is what we'll end on today, just the beginnings. Let's hear. What I want you to listen for is, I want you to stop being monotheistic, and if you're Christian or Jewish, well, you can be Jewish, I guess, but stop being Christian. To just clear your mind of the assumptions you have about God and you've been taught. And listen to these passages and tell me what is God? What are they describing for us? So let's hear the Job passage. I'm going to sit for just a second, so give my knees a rest while we're listening. Job?
I got it.
Thank you. My back is to you.
Yeah. One day, the heavenly beings came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, "Where have you come from?" Satan answered the Lord, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it." The Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil." Then Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not put a fence around him and his house and all he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand now, and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face."
Read a couple more, I'll tell you one more. Yeah.
The Lord said to Satan, "Very well, all that he has is in your power. Only
okay.
do not..."
That's good. That's good. "Only do not hurt him." Or do not kill him, right? Go ahead and hurt him all you want.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Okay, thank you. So how about 1 Kings 22, 19 to 22?
Then Micah said, "Therefore hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne with all the host of heaven standing beside him to the right and to the left of him. And the Lord said, 'Who will entice Ahab so that he may go up and fall at Ramoth Gilead?' Then one said one thing, and another said another, until a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord, saying, 'I will entice him.' 'How?' the Lord asked him. He replied, 'I will go out and be a lying spirit in the mouth of all his prophets.' Then the Lord said, 'You are to entice him, and you shall succeed. Go out and do it.'"
Thank you.
Yes.
How about Psalm 95, 3, and then 6 to 7?
"For the Lord is a great God, and a great King above all gods. Oh, come, let us worship and bow down. Let us kneel before the Lord, our Maker. For he is our God. We are the people of his pasture and the sheep of his hand."
Great, thank you. So who is God? Or what is God? Or what's happening?
He's the
up there?
The national spirit of Israel.
The national spirit of Israel? Okay. You got that from the text?
No.
Okay, we're looking at the text right now. Thank you, though. You're getting ahead of us, but you're right. You're not wrong. Yes.
I'm getting in this text, he's kind of like a commander or a general of a group of godly people.
Yeah, commander or a general. Yeah, we're doing exegesis right now.
Godly
we're looking
associates.
At these texts, and we're seeing what's in them, what blessings.
But I don't understand the lying person. That's kind of throwing me.
Yeah, I hear you. The lying thing.
That sounds like Satan to me.
Yep, in the back. Oh, up top. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know if anybody has ever read the Winds of War series, but in the second book, there's a Jewish guy who, well, I don't know who that is, but he gives a sermon about Job, that whole chapter, and he takes God to task. And he says he's petty, and he's doing all, you know, like, to take a bet with Satan, you know, to destroy this. Anyway, it's very much like he's so angry at God, it just takes him down and you know, and upholds Job, of course. But anyway, that was the first time I've heard that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, we hear about the patience of Job, and we don't hear about, you know, God's kind of a bully, and God takes a bet. There's a play, isn't there, called God's Favorite, that is the trial of God, and I can't quite remember, but I'm going to move on real quickly because we're almost done, and this will be the last thing. I better not talk while I write. There we go. Henotheism. These passages all illustrate a theology that was probably present in early Israel, all the way maybe up to the Babylonian captivity. Not monotheism, but henotheism, which is the belief that there are multiple gods, that God had a council, let me back up, multiple small g gods. They all have councils and conversation partners. So the person who unfortunately has been given this name, Satan, the name Satan comes from the Hebrew, ha, Satan. In Hebrew, ha means the, it's an article. Ha, Satan is the adversary, the devil's advocate, the one who pokes at the conversation to agitate. Unfortunately, that has become personified, or that became personified somewhere after the first century as an actual person that is the enemy. But Hasatan was part of the council of those on high, the celestial council.
Prosecuting attorney,
right. And so these passages illustrate in the conversation of the Bible But they have not arrived yet at the Shema in Deuteronomy, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one." That there was an earlier, in the progression of theology, or in the evolution, or however you want to say it, there was an earlier sense that there were multiple gods, and each god had a nation. So as you said, the one we call capital G God, they called, in the Bible, it's referred to as Lord with all the capital letters. We've called it Yahweh. That's not really how you say the the Hebrew, but that's how it's come to us. That God in these passages is the God of Israel. So when you see that in text, the God of Israel, they're really talking about, I just picture like a little silo, like this is our God. And so as we depart today, this will be the question, if I remember, that we'll start with tomorrow. What does that mean if every nation has their own God? And if while peoples are at war, that means the gods are at war as well. What does it mean to Israel that their temple where God lives has been destroyed? And we're not going to answer that right now, but just think about if the belief is there are many gods, and while we are at war, they are at war, what does that mean that the temple of God was destroyed? And we're going to end there. Thank you very much. Thank you. If you don't mind putting your Bibles back on the thingy, then the room will be ready for the next folks. So thank you.